Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Today, Mohamed El-Baradei and the nuclear watchdog agency he heads, the International Atomic Energy Agency, are the co-recipients of the Nobel Prize for Peace. The Nobel Prize Committee called El-Baradei an unafraid advocate for nuclear nonproliferation at a time when the threat of nuclear arms is again increasing. El-Baradei spoke in Vienna after getting word of the prize today.
I think the prize would strengthen my resolve to continue to speak truth to power, to continue to speak our minds. We have no hidden agenda except to ensure that our world continue to be safe and humane.
El-Baradei has held the position of director at the IAEA for 8 years. He initially enjoyed the support of the U.S., but after refusing to confirm White House allegations about Saddam Hussein's nuclear weapons program and stockpiles, he became the target of a failed White House effort to oust him. Joseph Cirincione is director for nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He joins us from Washington. And Joe, I guess this is a good day for everyone who works against the spread of nuclear weapons.
Oh, it absolutely is. The committee's recognition of the important role of inspectors, nuclear inspectors, and of the independence and integrity of the director himself can do a lot to both increase the voice of those who are looking for negotiated solutions to these crises and to underscore the importance of having an independent agency, one that doesn't buckle to the great powers of the day.
Well, let's remind ourselves. Mr. El-Baradei referred to the day the U.S. invaded Iraq as the saddest day of his life because he was convinced the administration's assertions about nuclear weapons would be proven wrong. In light of comments like that, which he made, you know, a year ago, do you think this award was a political move, a jab at the Bush administration?
There's always politics involved in awards like this, but it was more a statement of peace. The inspectors were the alternative to war. All the nations of the Security Council at the time advocated continuing the inspections that the IAEA and also UNSCOM were conducting. Remember, these are the inspectors that were finding no evidence of any kinds of weapons, particularly nuclear weapons. But the United States and the United Kingdom disparaged the inspectors, ridiculed El-Baradei and the other inspectors as bumbling Inspector Clouseaus that couldn't find a weapon if it was staring them in the face, and went ahead with war. We now know that they were wrong. El-Baradei was right. When he spoke to the Carnegie Endowment at our conference last year, he said if he had been given a few more weeks, he would have been able to declare that there were no nuclear weapons capabilities. Remember, it was the nuclear bomb, the mushroom cloud, that was the main public cause for going to war. We now know it was completely unnecessary.
Well, on the other hand, as you also know, Mohamed El-Baradei has intense critics who say he and his agency have been far too easy on countries like Iran, preferring negotiation instead of sanctions, even when it appears that negotiations are going nowhere.
There are those criticisms, and I have some sympathy with those criticisms. It's very tough to walk this diplomatic tightrope. I hope that the Nobel Peace Prize is not just a recognition of the past role he's played, but will encourage future accomplishments, including strengthening his role in these Iranian negotiations, making him feel, you know, stronger and more independent of both sides in this, not just the U.S., but also the Iranians.
Well, you know Mohamed El-Baradei personally. What is his commitment here? And it's obviously a fierce one. What is it?
Well, I do know him. I've met him several times over the past few years and had long conversations with him. He's a very educated, gentleman, wanted to have a third term as director. This was what the U.S. opposed, but he was committed to this cause. You know, he is dedicated to finding negotiated solutions to these crises, to establishing a stronger international inspection regime, strengthening the role of international law, rather than trying to resolve these crises through military means. He's a proud man. I think he's delighted that he's gotten this recognition through the Nobel Peace Prize, but I wouldn't at all call him vain or vainglorious or someone who's out, you know, seeking some higher office. I think this is it for him. This is the peak of his career.
Joe Cirincione is director of the Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. More than 250 Roman Catholic bishops are meeting for the first time under Pope Benedict XVI this week at the Vatican and discussing issues rarely raised at recent synods, including whether priests should be celibate and if Catholics can vote for politicians who disagree with church teachings. We'll have more on the synod in a few minutes. But first, while bishops in Rome are speaking out on issues that the Vatican once labeled taboo, officials in the American Catholic Church are being accused of cracking down on priests with outspoken views. This week, the Boston Archdiocese removed one of the most vocal critics of the church during the priest sex abuse scandal. Father Walter Kunin celebrated his last Mass as pastor of Our Lady of Help of Christians on Sunday, or rather, I should say, Our Lady Help of Christians on Sunday. The Archdiocese says Kunin was removed for accepting a $500 monthly stipend and a leased car from his parish. But parishioners say they had approved those expenses, and hundreds of them took to the streets in support of Kunin this week.
Would you like to sign the petition? It's to reinstate Father Kunin to investigate the process that led to this decision.
Yeah, this church is all of us, and it's not the hierarchy.
We're outraged that this could happen. He's a shepherd, and we feel kind of bereft without him.
This community has been robbed of a great priest.
We're fighting for control. We're fighting to be heard. This is our church, and we've been empowered by Walter.
I'm Father Tom Mavany, and I'm a priest of the Archdiocese of Boston. I'm not sure if I'm more afraid of my mother, who told me to stay away from the press, or of the leadership of my archdiocese, who expect me not to speak out. I am afraid.
That last speaker was Father Tom Mahoney of St. Patrick's Parish in Watertown, Massachusetts. He's also chair of the Boston Priests Forum, and he joins us first on the line. Welcome, Father.
Thank you.
And I want to start out by asking you, you just said, as we heard, that you were afraid to speak out against your church. Why are you afraid?
Well, because it directly affects my ability to be a pastoral leader. I'm a priest in the church, and what kinds of abilities that I would have to do my job.
Well, and as we've seen, some feel that other priests have been removed for speaking out. We just heard about Father Kunin, but also your cousin, Father Bob Bowers, mm-hmm. was also forced to resign last year by Archbishop Sean O'Malley. He's now at your cousin left his parish in Charlestown as part of a deal to keep his parish open, and he's yet to be reassigned. Mm-hmm. But what do you think? Do you think the Archdiocese is on a campaign to remove outspoken priests?
Well, to say that it's on a campaign, it might be overstated. I think that there is certainly a desire to try to create a more unified voice, which is more doctrinally conservative and focused, and people who vary from that are not really given too much credibility, and that they're trying to, you know, kind of remove that and say that there isn't any real ability to dissent from any kind of church teaching, that we're very clear and focused on what we teach.
Well, and there are some people who feel that if there is a campaign, there would be nothing wrong with that. We want to bring into the discussion Brian St. Paul. He's editor of Crisis Magazine. Brian, are you there?
I am.
Well, and as you well know, we've been speaking about different priests, including Father Walter Kunin.
Right.
His supporters say further that he was forced to resign because he didn't listen to church authorities. Most recently, he refused to take part in a church-sponsored signature drive. This is to collect enough signatures to have a constitutional amendment against gay marriage here on the Massachusetts ballot. As everyone knows, it's now legal here in Massachusetts. Do you think that Father Kunin was ousted because of his views? And if so, do you think that was appropriate?
I think both. I think it was appropriate, and I think he was ousted. The financial matter, as far as I can see, is fairly minor and simply a pretense. And I wish that the Archdiocese had been a little bit more clear in why they really did it. But I think it's certainly a legitimate thing. Catholic priests are Catholic priests and are expected to teach the Catholic faith, and there are certain doctrines around which we must maintain ourselves. And so there are areas where we can debate and disagree, but doctrine is doctrine. And so it's as simple as a truth in advertising.
Let's take this one petition drive as a matter around which there's been much debate and disagreement.
Sure.
Father Mahoney, have you been asked to take part in the signature drive, and do you agree with it?
Every pastor in the diocese was asked to make the petition available in church and to let the people in the parishes know of the bishop's statement about that petition. So we were certainly asked, and it wasn't that Father Kunin refused to do that. He just did it in a slightly different way by putting the petitions outside the church because he doesn't believe that petitions should belong in church. And, you know, the thing is, you need to bear in mind that these issues reside in two very different realms. One is ecclesiastical governance and policy, but the other is the pastoral practice of evangelizing and teaching the gospel. And my personal opinion is it's not very good pastoral practice to promote a religious perspective through the vehicle of civil government.
Well, Brian, I want to bring you in on that, Brian. That is the main criticism. Do political petitions belong in the church?
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I don't think Kunin was removed because he didn't place the petition in his church lobby.
But it probably didn't go over very well.
Well, I don't think it helped the whole situation, but I doubt that was the full reason why he was removed. Sure. I mean, Catholics have an obligation to take part in politics. And insofar as a law affects Catholic belief or moral teaching, that's a place where a bishop has a right to step in and take part in the political process. So I have no objection to the bishops doing that kind of thing.
Well, this is obviously one of those areas you mentioned where there's huge disagreement and debate. And
sure.
Father Mahoney, I want to ask you about another thought that we are hearing from parishioners, that the priests that are being removed are being replaced by conservative priests to rein in parishes. Are you seeing that?
Well, I can't really speak about what I don't know. There are just too many parishes and too many different situations. I can't say that I have seen anything systematic about putting more conservative priests in place.
Well,
however, you know, I mean, it does seem to have happened in the case with Father Kunin's parish.
Well, and I was going to ask you, what do you think of his replacement?
Well, you know, I personally wonder how somebody could not ask for a little lenience by the bishop in being sent into a place like that. I mean, we certainly are subject to obedience to our bishop, but obedience takes place in a dialogue, and it's hard to imagine that somebody would feel that they could step into a parish like that, you know, where there's been such hurt and such dishonesty.
Brian St. Paul, again, editor of Crisis Magazine. You've seen the protests, and perhaps people who are listening in across the country have seen television footage of protesters. The mass last Sunday, people who have attended it said it was a stomping, you know, people stomping their feet on the floors in support of Father Kunin. Is this a schism in the church? Is this a spasm? What is this?
Well, there has been for some years, some decades actually, a minor schism in the church where we have a circle of people in the church who are really materially non-Catholic, and yet they remain within the church. So I think that demonstration was an expression of that, but also an expression of pain. I mean, I acknowledge certainly there's a legitimate hurt that the parishioners feel in losing a priest that they love and have had for some time.
I'm going to hold you up there. That's Brian St. Paul, editor of Crisis Magazine. We're also speaking with Father Mahoney of St. Patrick's Parish here in Watertown, Massachusetts, about what's happening at the Archdiocese in Boston. We'll have more about what's going on at the Bishop's in Rome when we come back. But we're going to just take a minute break, gather some thoughts. Much more ahead here and now. About the Roman Catholic Church appearing to be at a crossroads, faced with priest shortages. We're going to be hearing more about that from Rome in just a moment. And an American church still reeling from the priest sex abuse scandals. And there are growing concerns that the church could eventually splinter in the U.S. We've been talking with Father Tom Mahoney of St. Patrick's Parish in Watertown, Massachusetts. And by the way, Father, I just have to ask you, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Good. Because it's spelled, as you know, Mahoney.
Right.
And Brian St. Paul, editor of Crisis Magazine. Welcome back, Brian.
Thank you.
And I want to raise the topic that's apparently being raised this week at the Bishop's Synod in Rome, the idea of priest shortages. We've been talking about the removal of priests. In light of the priest shortages, Father Mahoney, your thoughts on that?
Throughout the world, there are very varying situations of numbers of priests per Catholic. And the United States has always had, especially in the eastern part of the United States, has had a high ratio. We have more priests, and so there's a pastoral practice that develops out of that. you know, there's certainly more required or expected of priests in terms of being leaders in their congregations and, you know, what duties they might have.
I'm going to stop you there for a second because we only have about a minute left before we go to Rome. And Brian St. Paul, I just wanted to close out your thoughts in just the few seconds we have. You know, we are in the wake of a sex abuse scandal. Don't parishioners have the right to speak out, to question the authority, which they say let them down?
Oh, sure. I mean, parishioners have the right to do so, and I think that demonstration is an example of that. But ultimately, the bishop is the authority, and as Catholics, we have to be obedient to the bishop. We may not like the decision, but we have to acknowledge that he has the authority over his flock.
That's Brian St. Paul. He's editor of Crisis Magazine. We also spoke today with Father Tom Mahoney of St. Patrick's Parish in Watertown, Massachusetts. I want to thank you both for weighing in with us.
Thanks, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
And now we go to Rome, where Catholic bishops from around the world are speaking out, holding a synod, talking about issues that were once considered taboo, like celibacy and homosexuality in the priesthood, whether priests should be celibate, and if Catholics can vote for politicians who disagree with church teachings. Well, joining us now on the line from Rome is Washington Post correspondent Dan Williams. Dan, let's start with what's being reported about a forthcoming Vatican document that will apparently allow some room for gays to enter the priesthood.
Well, I myself haven't seen the document. In fact, I haven't run into anyone who has. But what is the buzz around town is that the Vatican cannot reach a precise ban on such a thing because it would mean banning a whole class of people. So at this point, it's not clear what's really going to change since over the last 45 years or so. The Church has repeatedly said that homosexuals should not be admitted, largely on the grounds that life in all-male cemeteries puts them in a risky atmosphere of temptation.
Well, we understand now that the new document, and again, it's speculation, but it's being reported that seminary officials will exercise prudential judgment and that gay candidates won't be admitted in three cases, and they're very specific, you know, if they've not demonstrated a capacity to live celibate lives, or if they've been seen, for instance, attending gay pride rallies. Is that a departure? In other words, sort of a don't ask, don't tell, or is that the same as always?
Prudence has always been one of the watchwords, or has been for the last several decades in this issue. The thing about not attending gay promotional events, I think, is something specific that is new in the sense that what the Church does not want to be seen is being a promotional vehicle for this state of being or lifestyle or whatever one thinks homosexuality is. And that's a rather pointed comment that also refers to bans on certain groups, Catholic homosexual groups, from using church property, which has been in force in the United States for several years, if they promote certain behaviors that the Church sees as wrong.
Another controversial issue being talked about is celibacy. We understand the head of the Melkite Catholics said that celibacy had no theological foundation. How'd that go over?
The interesting thing about his comments was not that he said them, but that this Pope has not been eager to have both sides of such an issue aired. That is, there is, by tradition, and in some case, some people say by theology, a ban on married priests. That it's being argued this forcefully right here in the Vatican is, I think, the most unusual thing about it.
It seems that the biggest issue that's come up is the shortage of priests, and all of these other issues sort of dovetail off that.
Well, that's right. The issue of homosexuality, the issue of married priests, and the issue of women priests, which I have not heard has been brought up here, all in some sense revolve around the difficulties of finding priests to fill parishes throughout the world.
So we're understanding that topics are being raised that, you know, as you said, don't normally get aired. Historically, a synod of bishops doesn't produce earth-shattering results. The Catholic Church is a slow-moving body. So what do you think is going to happen in the long run? Do you think there will be big changes just because there is a talk that's not usually heard?
Well, one of the things that's interesting about this meeting is, of course, none of these issues are secret. None of these things are things that people and Catholic writers in particular haven't been discussing, publishing, and so on. In a way, leading up to the death of the John Paul II, these things built up but weren't taken care of, in a sense. So I think that explains some of the passion with which these problems are being approached. It is the first early test of this new papacy under Benedict the 16th. Will he just take the recommendations and reports from the synod and stroke his chin and put them aside, or will there be some vehicle set for actually taking action on some of them?
That's Dan Williams. He's Rome correspondent for The Washington Post in Rome, where the bishops of the Roman Catholic Church are currently meeting. And this note, Monday on Here and Now, in 1492, Columbus discovered the New World, but apparently the New World was doing pretty well before he got there. We'll look at the Americas in 1491. That's Columbus Day. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR. This week, Energy Secretary Samuel Bodman warned that Americans could be paying higher energy costs for years because of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. And that's prompting some belt tightening. The governors of Florida, Minnesota, Maine, and New Mexico say they're giving up their SUVs for cars that burn less gas. But yesterday, the governor of Arizona drew the line and reversed an order that called for fewer police patrols in order to save gas. Well, are you using less energy now that President Bush has called for Americans to conserve it by driving less, turning down the heat this winter, or, as his EPA administrator said this week on NPR, changing at least one incandescent light bulb to an energy-saving fluorescent one? To some observers, President Bush's call for conservation is a stunning reversal from previous policy and is bringing to mind President Jimmy Carter, who in 1977 wore a gray cardigan sweater in a speech calling for conservation, and in 1979 called on Americans to turn down the thermostat.
In a nation that was proud of hard work, strong families, close-knit communities, and our faith in God, too many of us now tend to worship self-indulgence and consumption.
Boston University professor Bruce Schulman is an expert on the 70s. He joins us on the line. Welcome.
Great to be here, Robin.
You know, in a Sunday Washington Post op-ed piece, you wrote that President Bush finds himself now on the cusp of a new political order. Essentially, he's asking the nation to do something more than conserve energy. What is that? What are you seeing happening behind the call for conservation?
Well, I think the call for conservation in many ways culminates a subtle change in, if not in direction, at least in tone, over the past several months, where in ways reminiscent of Jimmy Carter, he's asking the United States and its citizens to recognize some limits. So limits to energy consumption, limits to the ability to project American military power abroad and the ambitions for that military power to transform the world. We've seen that in the very subtle downgrading of our objectives in Iraq and in the Middle East, and the new kind of language with which he's talking about the war on terror. And I think you can even see, to some extent, some limits on his ability to pursue his own domestic agenda at home.
Now, you say this sort of a metaphor in his huge, sprawling Crawford Ranch, which suggests, you know, the limitless possibilities as opposed to the constricting halls of the White House, which he's now back in.
Yes, I mean, I think it's fair to say that that President Bush has kind of made that Crawford Ranch, where he spent so much time in extended periods, a kind of symbol for his presidency and his looking west, the boundless frontier, the sense of the unbridled limits for American power, and also, I think, of almost limitless resources. And now, hunkered down in the White House in this post-Katrina, post-Iraq situation, there seems to be another kind of change in tone there.
But Professor Schulman, isn't there also a huge difference between the two presidencies? I mean, Americans believed that Jimmy Carter wore sweaters and probably made the White House turn the thermostat down. And, you know, when we heard him just sort of scolding Americans for indulgence and consumption. That's something they felt he believed in. Do you get the sense that President Bush is comfortable with this call?
Well, I don't think he's comfortable with this call at all, and I think you're right. I mean, to some extent, a president who, even in the face of tremendous national emergencies, has kind of asked not for sacrifice, but for the country to shop and spend its way out of emergency, probably is not as convincing as Jimmy Carter was in making those kinds of calls for recognition of limits and for national sacrifice. On the other hand, we also have to remember that the country has changed a lot over these past 30 years, and it's come around very much to President Bush's way of thinking, with the idea that we should rely more on the market to solve our problems. And so now one of the questions that we have to wonder is, are we at a kind of crossroads where the United States and its political leaders are going to begin to think more in terms that Jimmy Carter did than we have in the Reagan, Clinton, and through the Bush years?
Well, and mindful of the fact that they might have believed that President Carter wore a gray sweater at home, but they didn't much like it, threw him out of office, and voted Ronald Reagan in.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I think with Jimmy Carter, it wasn't so much that they didn't like the message. And in fact, there's a lot of evidence that Americans responded very well to President Carter's call for sacrifice, sometimes too well. When he asked the country to cut back on credit card spending in the last year of his presidency, the response was so overwhelming, so much more than they expected, that it caused a recession, which very much hurt his reelection chances. But certainly, I think the problem with Jimmy Carter was more the execution. And that, I think, gets at an interesting parallel to this President Bush, because Jimmy Carter was much more effective in laying out his vision than in actually accomplishing things on Capitol Hill and in Washington, and in part because he had to deal with his own party's majority on Capitol Hill that did not share his approach and did not accept the idea that the political landscape had changed and that his own Democratic Party had to give up on some of their most dearly held beliefs and priorities. Well, now, President Bush, to the extent he wants to move toward a greater role for government in rebuilding after Katrina and more hands-on conservation-type measures, has to face his own very strong Republican majority in the Congress that is very much against these things, against conservation, against the new role for government, against federal spending, against slowing down tax cuts. And so he, I think, to the extent that he wants to move in that direction, he's going to have to finesse it, and he's going to find it very hard to control his own caucus on Capitol Hill.
And he's maybe going to have to take up more imagery of his own, you know, trading in the pickup on the ranch for a Prius and maybe being, you know, seen switching light bulbs.
Well, the symbolism can be important. I mean, sometimes the symbolism symbolism can backfire. I mean, when Richard Nixon dimmed the Christmas lights in the White House during the first oil embargo, and that sort of didn't have the effect that he wanted of trying to rally the country to conservation. So the symbolism can be very tricky, but I think you're right. I can't imagine this president driving a Prius instead of a Ford pickup truck, but you maybe can imagine him, you know, echoing that call to replace the light bulbs with more energy-efficient ones.
Bruce Shulman, professor of history at Boston University, the author of The 70s. Professor, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And still to come, with one writer in hot water after writing a memoir, we'll speak with author Mary Carr about the art of the form. You're listening to Here and Now. Sufi Sufism is an ancient knowledge and a mystical branch of Islam. Embraced by the poet Rumi, it expresses love of God in an ecstatic whirling dance. Islamic Sufism also led to a broader, more universal form that is both a belief and a way of life, respectful of all faiths, seeing in each a path to truth with a message of love, harmony, and beauty. But the whirling dervishes of Istanbul are Islamic Sufis. They perform the spiritual ritual, the sima, spinning like tops across a stage for minutes at a time, performing a precise choreography while seeming to be in a meditative stance, gentle turns becoming more and more intense as the dervishes become spellbound, the only sound, the whisper of their long white skirts, and the live music. The whirling dervishes of Istanbul live in Turkey but are currently traveling the world. They're performing at Harvard Sanders Theater tonight. And a member of the company is with us now. Welcome, Akun.
Thanks.
And also Cenk, their tour manager. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Cenk, let's start with you. We understand that Sufism is Islam, but it's considered a more mystical form of Islam. How is that?
As a matter of fact, I'm glad that you asked this question because a lot of people have misunderstandings about this issue. It's not a different form of Islam. It's the kind of higher level of Islamic ritualism in a very poetic approach.
And how is whirling a spiritual practice?
We should ask Akun, I guess.
Akun, you are the one who whirls. What is the religious aspect or the spiritual aspect of whirling? Is it to get into a trance? Is it to get in touch with God? What?
Ben sema yaparken,
as a matter of fact, when we get into the sema ritual and whirling, every single movement has a symbol. And these symbols are related to the rituals of God. For instance, they use their hands in different ways, and then they symbolize like God is the one and only. And then,
for instance, he was just putting his hands
like this,
and folding them across his chest,
yes,
with one hand on each shoulder.
That means the one and only. They refer to God as one and only.
And what happens when the dervishes put their hands out to the side in their world?
Elin aşkı zaman, actually, they get rid of their self-centeredness.
Sağ kolumuz yukarıda.
When get their hands towards to God.
One hand up towards God.
Yeah, that means we take it from the God, love from the God, and then they do it downwards.
One hand down towards the ground.
Halka alıp halka vermek.
Then when you take it from the God, you can teach, you can show the way how to get to from God and then give it back to the people.
Akun, what does it feel like when you whirl?
Ben biraz daha yakınlaştığımı hissediyorum. Bu
it's a kind of self-education. It's a kind of self-education in a way that he get rid of the world issues. Then he gets closer to the God. He whirls and whirls and whirls and he gets closer to the God. Actually, he gets rid of all his desires, manly desires.
Yeah.
It gets the feeling of spirituality.
Is it a trance?
Kind of trance.
But there's also moments when I wonder, I mean, you are spinning like a top. You're never looking where you're going, coming so close to the edge of the stage. Do you ever worry that you'll fall? That
semanın bir felsefesi var, kesinlikle.
Although there is a kind of spirituality, of course, there is a kind of technique about this dancing. So they get that education too. People go through 1 year education about that dance movements.
Traininglerimiz var bizim.
And they have a lot of trainers about that. I mean, the experienced ones. But on the other hand, in a parallel way, you follow the thoughts of the spiritual leader and you follow the thoughts of Quran,
the thoughts,
and you can trust, you never fall. You can trust.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming in to talk to us about the whirling dervishes of Istanbul.
Thank you. It's been nice talking to you.
The Whirling Dervishes of Istanbul are performing tonight at Harvard Sanders Theater here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, but they're also touring the country. So for more, go to our website here-now.org. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. Austin Burroughs, author of the smash bestseller and soon-to-be-major Hollywood film Running with Scissors, is being sued by his foster family. In the book, he says that he was taken in by a psychiatrist whose family engaged in all manner of bizarre behavior, and the family is now saying they were defamed. Augustine Burroughs has waded into the difficult waters of the memoir. Mary Carr has been there. Her bestseller, 1995's The Liars Club, has been called the catalyst of a recent memoir explosion in America. It's a darkly funny tale of an East Texas childhood filled with revelations of sexual abuse, alcoholism, and mental illness in her family. How do you write your story when it involves other people? Mary Carr has interviewed a number of memoir writers. She teaches memoir as literature at Syracuse University, and she joins us on the line. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, New York Times critic Michiko Kakutani called The Liars Club one of the most dazzling and moving memoirs to come along in a long time. Your follow-up book, Cherry, was also a bestseller. But how did your family respond to the books?
Well, in my family, anybody who's able to make a living is, you know, has won a raffle. So I've got to say, they were very pleased. So I'm surprised to hear that someone's in a position to be sued by people who, you know, occupied such a large portion of the book.
Right.
Because in my experience, memoirs don't have that difficulty. Most memoirs, you know, you're going to have to keep eating Thanksgiving dinner with these people. So.
Well, let me ask you, how do you do that, Mary Carr? I mean, Augustine Burroughs, for instance, changed the name of his foster family, but they say that everybody in the town they lived in knew it was them. They knew he was their foster child. When do you fictionalize? How do you navigate that?
I made up the name of the town.
Ah.
And in the case of the boy who sexually abused me when I was little, I was trying to think. My fear was actually more that someone would be accused of it or thought to be that person who wasn't. So I gave the person braces because no one in our neighborhood could afford braces. So there was no one who had braces. The other reason I made up the name of the town was that there were people who were very minor characters, the principal of the grade school, the fire chief, you know, people like that who I just felt shouldn't be indicted or put under a microscope when I didn't have that much investment in how they did or didn't appear.
What do you tell students? Do you tell them to go speak to the people who are going to be written about? I mean, how do you approach it?
What I did is what I recommend to people, which is I spoke to everybody who was going to feature in a big way in the book before I wrote the book. And that meant saying to my mother, you know, I'm going to cover your psychotic break. Hmm. And like I said, I mean, everybody was so tickled that anybody was going to make a living. My family, everybody was happy about it. My mother was also quite an outlaw. She was somebody not over worried about how she appeared in public. My sister, who was much more circumspect, I think, was uncomfortable. But like me, and I think like most memoirists, you manage to develop a kind of psychotic denial system where you just pretend that people don't know all this stuff. It's the same denial system, by the way, that permits you to continue to eat holiday meals with people you know to be, you know, sometimes a little dicey in terms of, you know, how they are. I warned people in advance, and with Cherry, the same thing. My three friends who figured most prominently, one of whom was a drug dealer, I changed their names. I changed some key physical features.
So make sure I'm hearing you right. It sounds as if, Mary Carr, you're saying that the same thing that allows you to let things happen to you, abuse or whatever, with sort of making believe it's not happening, it's the same mechanism that allows you to write about it later, thinking, well, maybe this won't bother anybody I write about it.
Well, I've been writing poetry for 20 years when I published my first memoir, so the idea of anybody reading anything I wrote was a little comical to me.
Is there a part of that to memoirists that they don't really, in some cases, maybe think through, wow, this is going to be read by a lot of people and maybe made into a movie?
Well, I mean, you have a choice over whether it's made into a movie or not. I mean, no one puts a gun to your head and makes you make a movie of it. In my case, I had the really happy occasion of having the book bought and paid for and not just optioned for the film and then had the film not made. And some ways that's the happiest thing, because obviously you don't want to see yourself on the, or I don't want to see us on the silver screen. I can just imagine all kinds of grotesque ways that can come out. I mean, to me, the thing that's great about a memoir as a written form is that it permits you to see the complexity of character that you can't see in a soundbite, that you can't see on a TV show or in a film. You read a book and you can read the pressures that were maybe operating on my mother that might have made her go so crazy. The other thing I tell students is never to write out of revenge or to settle a score. I think if you write out of anything but love, it's a slippery slope because, you know, you're making yourself judge and jury and executioner in a way.
I wanted to ask you a little about that Rashomon aspect of memoir. I'm thinking of Evelyn, which was made into a film starring Pierce Brosnan. It portrayed an Irish father who is trying to win custody of his children after the mother walks out. Well, the real-life mother's second family said that they didn't recognize the callous woman in the book and the film, and that she, in fact, said she was abused by the husband who was portrayed so heroically. So I'm just wondering, do you caution about that as well? You know, there may be someone else who has a very different side of the story you're writing.
Yeah, well, they can write their own book, you know. But yeah, somebody has it. No, but I mean, again, I think readers understand. I think the only person who was a villain in my book, other than the person who, you know, sexually assaulted me when I was a kid, and that's, you know, 2 pages of a 400-page book. It's not in any way the central event of the book. I think most people appear in a very complex way, except for maybe my grandmother. And I even say in the book, I know that this, you know, I'm remembering this through a child's eye, and she was such a demon to me. And my sister remembers her this other way. I don't feel obliged, as I'm writing, to render my sister's point of view. But I do say, you know, she had a brain tumor. There were a lot of sad things in her life to make her, you know, not so fun to be around. But she made my mother cry. And that was it for me. That was a deal breaker. So, I mean, I would assume that anybody reading that portrait of my grandmother would assume, as I, you know, urge them to do, that it was a very warped portrait. And I also think that you have a contract with readers today that, you know, this is subjective, and as such, it's necessarily corrupt. I think most readers would experience it as corrupt. I haven't read the Augustine Burroughs book. But I erred so far on the other side. I can't imagine it. I can't imagine anyone, you know, my mother and sister both read the book, and my friends read Cherry before it went to press. And I, you know, everybody had an opportunity, had a veto opportunity. Yeah. I loved what Toby Wolfe said about this boy's life. He said, my mother corrected spelling and some proper names, and a dog that I said was ugly, she thought was quite good looking. You know, so that was the kind of, in my experience, that was the kind of thing that was corrected in my manuscript. So it's a kind of a horrible prospect, you know.
To get sued by a dog?
Well, to get sued for making things up when you're putatively making your living as a truth teller. You know, it's enough to run you out of the memoir business.
Mary Carr, author of several books, including The Liars Club and Cherry. She is also a professor of literature at Syracuse University. Mary Carr, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. You'll forgive me, but go Red Sox. And please, join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time.